utilizing antioxidant to increase axillary shoot proliferation rate of Japanese elm.
Right. Good morning, everyone. So this research was stimulated by a release in 2014 out of the program that I direct now at NDSU, and it's a new Japanese elm cultivar. We are seeing the revival of elm, and especially now with some of these DED resistant. This is a really nice selection. We're going to get into propagation, but with the idea now with the nursery trade is that nurseries are no longer utilizing or doing the research for the propagation. They require us to give them a protocol. And so every time now that we have a release, we actually have to give them that at the same time. A Japanese elm, Ulmus davidiana, variety japonica, typically is about 40 to 60 foot. This release is topping out at about 28 to 30 foot. So it's a much smaller, compact, has a rounded crown, has some really nice traits to it. Very limited with the disease aspects. We don't see the black leaf spot. Like I said, it has the inherent DED resistance. It is a cooler season elm, so we're looking at more of the zone 3 to 6. But what's so special about it really is the fall color. And that's what's really unique about it is that it gets a nice burgundy fall color. And there is only one other cultivar of elm that gets the burgundy fall color. So hopefully this will be something that the nursery trade will really, really like. Super high quality foliage in the summer. So we really wanted to propagate this because this was a single seedling selection and to be able to get it into the nursery trade. The fall color kind of goes from an apricot orange and then it fades into or gets into the dark burgundy color that we see in the fall. And it's quite long-lasting, which is really exciting. The other cultivar that I've mentioned is Frontier. Now, this is a warmer cultivar, and so we're looking where you get more into the zone 7s and 8s. But it is a hybrid of Chinese and smooth leaf, the European, and so it is susceptible to DED, even though a lot of the literature says that it's resistant. But I was just at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum, and they took their Frontier down because they had Dutch elm disease. So they are susceptible. But what we find in zone 4 for us is that they're not really hardy. Elm typically is propagated two ways, grafting and by cuttings. More often by grafting, because as we all know, it's really quick to be able to get the numbers in a woody species with grafting. The nursery trade is trying to get away from that. They want to get everything on their own roots, finding that they perform better, but more importantly is that a lot of the elms have been grafted onto Siberian. And if you're familiar with Siberian elm, we have a lot of Siberian elm, it is highly, highly invasive. And so the nursery trade is always worried about if you're grafting on a rootstock that's highly invasive, obviously if the top dies back, now you've got something that's very problematic. When placing into tissue culture, so that's the first venue we wanted to look at is with tissue culture, can we get it on its own roots? Can we get good growth? And elm typically responds when you put it into tissue culture with lots of callus. Has a lot of endogenous auxin, and you end up with an imbalance of callus versus shoot growth. This was documented in several of the species of elm, but not in Japanese. And so we wanted to see if Japanese would behave the same way, so we put it in a normal regime of tissue culture, looking at some cytokinins and different concentrations, and we ended up with fairly poor growth. And here you can see the amount of callus, and this is within a week. And it's just amazing. So if you ever want to create callus cultures and you need that, go with elm, because they produce very well with callus. And so the objectives then were to look at what can we do to try to reduce that callus. And so what we did is we did a nutrient salt formulation screening and then wanted to look at the use of PCIB, the chlorophenoxyisobutyric acid, which is a known antioxidant compound. And so if you're not familiar with PCIB, it's a very interesting compound. There are some synonyms out there, so just to be aware, but here's the structure. It is a benzene ring with a chlorine, and it has a typical active acid group with two methyl groups located within that acid group. It is also known as chlorofenoxy-2-methylpropionic acid, and also clofibric acid, which is actually clofibric acid is used in the medical industry for some treatments. But how does it work? And here I have the structure of PCIB on the left, and then comparing it to another synthetic auxin that is very similar in structure on the right. And as we know, back to our plant prop classroom days, when we talk about auxin, the lock and key method, where we have the synthetic and then another compound that comes in that's very similar in size, structure, that key then can fit into the lock and have similar results. That's why we know that synthetic auxins, you know, how they behave similar to our endogenous natural auxins. And so the idea is that it could be affecting the auxin receptor. There has been a lot of work done now on the molecular activity of PCIB, and it's found that it really affects the auxin gene expression, obviously with the receptor site. And what it's doing is that it's actually reducing the accumulation of the transcripts from the AUX-IAA genes. And it's also affecting the protein stability of the AUX-IAA proteins. And really reducing the gene transcript component, and then affecting then the secondaries dealing with the auxin response. So for our materials and methods, for the nutrient salt formulation, we're looking at high, medium, low level salts. So we used MS, DKW for our high, LP for our medium, and WPM for our low. We used three different concentrations of PCIB. None, 5, and 10 micromolar. All of the factorial combinations contain 2.2 micromolar BA. We wanted to keep that consistent. I didn't want to have a three-way factorial here. And our typical sucrose level, pH of 6, and standard auger. They were transferred every 6 weeks, the nodal segments. They were two nodal segments in length. 6 weeks, total culture period of 12. Each transfer date, we took data on shoot number and prop number. And our propagule was, like I said, the two nodes, about 10 millimeters in length. So here's just a photograph of what the propagule looks like. So just a standard two-node segment. And after 6 weeks, we get the multiple shoots, which is quite desirable, get really good axillary shoot proliferation. And then on the right, you can see the nodal segments that result. So, you know, this is just showing the growth and then the potential for the prop number that we get out of it. And so with our results, we actually did see that there was a significant factorial with our nutrient salts and the PCIB. And I really want to highlight the DKW and the 10 micromolar PCIB. And with that, because we ended up with the highest axillary shoot number is what we're always looking for. But more importantly is that it's great to have the shoots, but if they don't elongate and create the propagules, then it's really not that worth it. And so the propagation number, we saw that the DKW and the 10 micromolar as well produced the highest number for our propagules. And so we still get, and see in this picture here, there still is a significant amount of callus, but it's, and I should have put a before and kind of after shot, and I did not include that, and I apologize, of the amount of callus. The amount of callus that the culture has produced is significantly reduced with the PCIB being present. And so I think then allowing our balance between our cytokine and then the auxin to finally be in check where we really want it to be and to be able to produce enough shoots. So in conclusion, we did see a significant interaction. DKW with the 10 micromolar PCIB reduced that basal callus production and did increase our shoot number, but more importantly, our prop number as well. Future research that we're going to be looking at is I want to see if we bump up that PCIB a little bit higher, what would happen. So we're doing that right now. But then also we need to do subsequent research on rooting out of these microcuttings to see, is there a lingering effect with the PCIB? Will that reduce our rootability of these in vitro and ex vitro? And that's what we're conducting right now as well. In other studies with other species, it was shown that there was no effect, no lingering effect of the PCIB with rooting, and we're hoping that Japanese elm falls into the same category. With that, I'll take any questions. Yeah.
Remember on the shoot that you used for your explant, was it right up near the tip or further down?
For the original collection?
Yeah.
Yeah, we were doing shoot tips. Yeah.
Manufacturing your PCIB yourself, or
no? Purchasing it from Sigma.
Where?
From Sigma. Yeah, and it's really not that expensive, and because that was one thing I was talking to John Priest, because he was very interested in that as well, because he's got a couple of species that are throwing a lot of callus as well, and so first thing he asked, is it expensive, and is it autoclavable? And it's like no and yes, so. So I think it's very practical for then a commercial producer to be able to utilize as well. And ultimately for us, that's what we need.
I don't know if you mentioned it or has this been, the PCIB been used on other elms?
Yes, it has. Yeah, American elm has been documented, and that's where we discovered it in the literature search, and I wanted to see if would Japanese behave similar, and it does behave very similar. American elm, they found that the best treatment was 5 micromolar, and we were seeing that 10 micromolar is more effective. All right. Well, thank you.